Searching for answers. You're asking here and there. Trying to solve your problem. But it seems like no one cares. You may have fasted. But when you got up off of your knees,
yeah.
Seemed like all of your problems decided to stay. It may look like the end, but God has the last. He has the last word. Sometimes you feel like you're the only one that is going through. I've even asked myself, does God really know what I'm going through? Then I know no weapon formed against me shall prosper. And I know he'll never put more on me than I can bear. But if God brought me to the problem.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring for a development director. Our development director oversees KBOO's fundraising, donor and business outreach, and leads the development team with light supervisory duties. Our ideal candidate has at least 4 years of proven development experience in the nonprofit sector, preferably with significant foundation and major donor fundraising work. For a complete job description and instructions on how to apply, visit kboo.fm/employment. Apply by February 24th. KBOO is an affirmative action and equal opportunity employer.
Welcome to An Islamic Point of View, a production of the Muslim Community Center of Portland and this station. Today, we launch our Black History Month programming with Sister Aisha Prime today, talking about Islam and Black America.
جزاكم الله خيرا السلام عليكم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا مولانا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم. You know, when I think about coming together for this program and why is it significant for us to have a conversation, of course, about Islam, Black America, and meaningful solidarity. You know, Muslims, we have respect for our origin. We have respect for our history. This is why we love the seerah of the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam, because we love to hear about the beginnings of Islam. We love to hear about how their communities interacted with revelation. We love to hear about how that history affected them and how it now relates to us. And so even in our own personal history, in our familial and cultural history, we love to hear the stories about our family and how they either began practicing Islam, or who was that relative that converted to Islam, or how did Islam reach my land. We love to hear those origins. Because they give us a sense of self. They give us a sense of not only our history, but our purpose. And so in talking about this particular topic, Islam in Black America, it does exactly that. It gives us our origin. It tells us our history. It tells us who we are. In fact, it is the very basis for which we base our claim that not only are we Americans, but we're as American as apple pie. We're more American than apple pie. It is the basis of our claim to this land, and for us it makes us our spine straighten up. It causes us to say that I have a legacy and it's connected to this land. And that's extremely important when you're talking about a land and heritage, because this is actually from Maqasid al-Sharia. Right? The preservation of heritage. The preservation of lineage. But if you don't know it, you can't preserve it. And so I want to actually start off this evening with a bit of a, presentation that's a bit fun for me. So if you can see, there are lots of images of past and present Muslims that have affected all of our lives in many ways. All right, while we're getting started, I'm going to start in West Africa. And it's extremely important to start in West Africa for a multitude of reasons. First, as Muslims, it's extremely important about where we begin our history. And that's important for all of us. And it's important where we begin our history, because it's important that we don't begin our history as a reaction to someone else. It's important that we don't begin our history as an afterthought, as a reaction to someone else's program, what someone else was doing. If we begin our history, many times when you think about African American history or Black American history, we begin with slavery. But the reality of it is that the Black American or the African American did not begin with slavery. They didn't somehow just pop up when slave catchers arrived, then all of a sudden they became human beings. In reality, it's important so that we can begin to respect and understand their full humanity. That these were architects, these were farmers, these were mothers and fathers and engineers and historians and scholars who were then kidnapped and captured and sold into slavery. That's different than beginning to look at them as an enslaved people. Because if you look at them from the position of slavery, if you start your story there, you automatically put them from a perspective of colonialism. You automatically reduce their humanity to being the property of someone else. So it becomes significant that we say, no, let's back that up. Who were they that they enslaved? Let's give them faces. Let's give them names. And it's important. You might say, well, why would you even mention color? Like, as Muslims, we're told often over and over again not to acknowledge someone's color. Why would we acknowledge their color? Because the color, for example, if you were to remove my color, that's called erasure. That means you remove my history. That means you remove where I came from. That means you remove the struggle that caused me to arrive to the human being that I am. So to remove my color is to erase a part of my history and to erase a part of my humanity. It's to ignore what is the vessel that Allah Ta'ala brought me through. And so if you're a Palestinian, I want to respect you as a Palestinian, because that's a serious struggle that comes with greatness. If you're a Latin American and you're from Mexico, I want to respect that, because that comes with a culture and a history and a legacy. And so I just want to mention that as we're having this discussion, what we're trying to do is to not do what others have attempted to do to us, and that is to erase us, right? But to tell our story with authenticity. So in Muslims in America before Columbus, and you will find this detailed in several books, you will find this detailed more prominently, of course, with Deeper Roots with Dr. Abdullah Hakim Quick. You will find it also in a book called They Came Before Columbus with Ivan Van Sertima. that Muslims in America before Columbus, I'm going to start with this particular story. There's some actually that are dated from the 9th and 10th century, but I'm going to start with this one because it's one of my favorites. And it's because we're actually someone, we're familiar with Mansa Musa. That one actually does make the pages of the American history books. They will mention Mansa Musa in some counties. And so Mansa Musa was actually known to be so wealthy, one of the wealthiest Muslims in the world. He was known to be responsible for Timbuktu and the great scholars that came to Timbuktu and spread Islamic scholarship throughout West Africa and into East Africa and into Central Africa. We know about his Hajj and how he was so wealthy and he gave so much charity that it changed the currency. But we never asked the question, how did Mansa Musa become king? How did he become a leader? It's actually because of his brother. His brother before him was actually an adventurer. He was a voyager. And so he was extremely interested in that which was west to him. He was extremely interested in what he had heard sayings about a land beyond the ocean. And so he initially sent 200 ships to the coast of America. And he sent those 200 ships with enough food to last them for over a year. And so when he waited for those ships to return, and only one ship returned. And when this sailor gave his account, he said, "Oh, leader Omansa, basically a storm came, and in this large storm, we begin to see sinks fall into like a cyclone. And so when we saw them fall, I was able to turn my ship around and I came back." And so Mansa Abu Bakr, who was the brother of Mansa Musa and also the second son of Sheikh Antajob, the great historian and scholar of West Africa. When he heard this, he said, "I know there's something beyond the storm." So what he decided was, he said, "I'm going to send 2,000 ships this time." And so with 1,000 ships of men and women and another 1,000 full of their resources, their supplies, and their food to last them, they set sail to America. Now, there are many accounts, questions whether or not they actually arrived in America, and it isn't until much later in history that we actually find out that they do. The first one arrives in the map called the Piris Reis map that is found in Turkey. And interestingly about this map is that there is Mandinkan script written upon it. Mandinkan script from the same tribe that Mansa Abu Bakr was from. But even more significant than that was the details of this map had shown details that no other map before it had mentioned. That it had details of the internal landscape of the Mississippi River, of mountains and mountain ranges inside of America. And so as they begin to research this map a little bit further, what they discover is that Mansa Abu Bakr was at least one of those who contributed to this map. Later on, we actually find in America as well as in South America some gold coins. And these coins actually have Mandinka written on them, and we find out that they're from the time of Mansa Abu Bakr. Another thing happens is that when Columbus actually does come to America, he can't say that he discovered, but when he does actually arrive to America, one of the things that he finds is he finds the tip of a spear. And the Native Americans called the spear guanin. Why is that important? Because guanin was actually a Mandinkan word for gold. And so in this, the tip of the spear, what was known about the people of Mansa Abu Bakr is that the spear they would use to make it, 60% of it was made from gold, another portion from silver, and another portion from copper. And this was something that was unique to their people. And guanin is actually a West African term, as I mentioned before, to mean gold. Another thing is that later on they discover in Arizona, in a cave in Arizona, they found a particular cave painting. And the cave painting, initially they thought this was maybe some ancient Native American language, turned out it's Mandinkan. And what does it say? It says the elephants are sick. What is significant about the elephants are sick is that there are no elephants that are, elephants are not native to America. So these elephants actually arrived with, it was known that Mansa Abu Bakr actually brought elephants with him because he thought, I also want to bring the some of the animals from this land and cultivate it here if this is where we're going to be. And so this is the beginning, actually, of many stories. Later on, we find in Cherokee narratives where there were not only stories of West Africans having come, lived, married, conducted business with Native Americans who were living in what we now know today as America, but also there were found Sharia documents of contracts, marriage contracts, business contracts, land ownership. And so this is extremely important when we're talking about Muslims, not only when we're talking about Muslims being indigenous to America, because these West Africans didn't live in a bubble, right? They immediately interacted and engaged and married with Native Americans who were here on the soil, making many, 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 and I don't have enough time to go into that. Inshallah, maybe we can have a Native American History Day. Love. And so, but we do know that there are multiple nations that came in contact and actually converted to Islam. Many of them, for example, even the word Tallahassee is a Native American word for Allah Ta'ala will deliver us in the future. You know Tallahassee, Florida? I was about to say, I'm like, y'all, come on, wake up. All right. On this map, this actually shows multiple expeditions that happened not only once, but multiple times between West Africa, that being Guinea, Mali, Senegal, as well as in Northern Africa, between the West African coast into the Americas, the Caribbean, and into South America. I want to fast forward into the history that we're more familiar with, and that I call the history of the Quran in chains. And I call it the history of the Quran in chains is because specifically what we learned from Dr. Bilal Ware's book, as well as from his presentation 2 years ago, that many of those, the low estimates, you know, they like to lowball us, the low estimates of Muslims coming to the shore are about 35%. Some of the more accurate are about 60%. And so those arriving to the shores of America being Muslim, many of them were not what West Africans called the walking Quran. And the reason why they would call them the walking Quran is because they were Hufad. They had memorized the Quran. And so they considered them a walking Quran. That was their definition of them. And so many of them who were actually captured and sold into slavery were not only Hufad, many of them were students of Hadith, were students of Fiqh, and were brought to the shores of America. Allah is amazing. And so there's one particular, so when they arrive to America, there are two things that happen. Number one is that they're known for spreading their religion. They were so much known for spreading their religion that it actually, they made it a law that if they caught you calling the adhan, they would cut out your tongue. And then if there would be different levels of punishment if they caught you making salah. And so many times West Africans would begin to hide their ibadah in different forms. And this actually, we find even some of those same acts of worship that were basically ibadah, Muslim ibadah, hidden in other forms. We actually find that even still present in Sapelo, on Sapelo Island, in some of the islands off the coast of South Carolina. Thank you for that. There's one particular subject I actually want to highlight. So these are the ones that we're familiar with, and that's Ayub Suleiman Jallo, who was also known as a Quranic scholar. He spoke over 5 different languages, Arabic being one of them. Yaro Mahmoud, who actually lived and established a bank, was part of a bank stakeholder here in Georgetown, Washington, D.C. Omar ibn Sa'id, who was also someone who was a hafiz of Quran, and actually pretend, because of his connection, they used to, they basically used to like to be close to him because of his level of language. And in one case, they would say that they befriended him, but mostly they were keeping a very close watch on him because of his, that he basically knew more languages than them. And so one of the things they asked him to write the Lord's Prayer in Arabic. And so he actually wrote something in Arabic that they posted in their home and later became a museum piece that they believed was the Lord's Prayer in Arabic, and turned out he had actually wrote Surah An-Nasr. Sheikh Abdurrahman Ibrahim Ibn Soro was, if you are you familiar with the book or you've seen the movie Prince Among Slaves, he was actually a prince in Fouta Jalon in West Africa, a very well-known, like, beautiful kingdom where he was actually the leader of over 2,000 soldiers. And so when he was sold into slavery, it became quickly known of his level of intelligence. And so slave masters actually used to try to keep him close to be, basically to be an overseer over those who were on the plantation. Eventually, he wrote a letter to his family in West Africa, and he wrote it in Arabic. Basically, when they saw that, they said, he's a Moor. He must be of... So they actually sent the letter to the leader of Morocco at the time, and they arranged for his return to West Africa. But what happens is that once he returned, his family had also been sold into slavery. I want to go into, fast forward into 1918. Many people think that there's a long gap between enslaved Africans in America and actually Muslims practicing Islam. But actually, the more and more historians come about with this, where that gap is getting smaller and smaller. Some used to think it was about 100 years. Now we're up to just about a 40-year gap. And I'm sure, bi-idhnillah, with just a couple of more years studying with, like, Habib Rasul Miller, that gap will continue to close. In 1918, we find the likes of a man by the name of Sheikh Daoud Faisal. And Sheikh Daoud Faisal is in Harlem, New York. You will see in the middle, this is the picture of his wife. And his wife, her name, they used to call her Sayyidah Khadija. And they called her Sayyidah Khadija because she was the wife of Sheikh Daoud Faisal, who basically began the first, what we call the Islamic Muslim mission, which will be known as the first Black Sunni Muslim movement. Now, to this side of it, no, I want to go to the other side, actually. Around the same time, you see that picture is taken in 1928. This is an organization of Muslims that are actually a spin-off of Noble Drew Ali. What is significant about Noble Drew Ali is that Noble Drew Ali was actually influenced by the man by the name of Marcus Garvey. Raise your hand if you heard of Marcus Garvey. Alhamdulillah, some of you. Now, Marcus Garvey is extremely important for us to know because the father of El-Hajj Malik Shabazz, Malcolm X, was a Garveyite. He was a follower of Marcus Garvey. And just to tell you some significance about that, Marcus Garvey, in the last pages of his book, he actually gives a warning to white Americans, and particularly Christians. And he says to them, basically, if you don't begin to interpret your religion correctly, then you leave our people no other choice than to return back to the God, to return back to Allah, the God of Africa. How does Marcus Garvey know about Allah? And why is he saying that he's the God of Africa? What is he saying? He's saying that. And so what Marcus Garvey was aware of was that, subhanAllah, Marcus Garvey was aware of that this was the religion of those who traveled from West Africa. Both of these movements, including the one further than that, which we're most familiar with, comes in 1930s in Detroit, which is the Nation of Islam. Most of us are most familiar with the Nation of Islam, but it's interesting because it doesn't come to more than a decade later than after the Islamic Muslim mission, as well as what's called the State Street Mosque, which was a masjid that was run by Sayyidah Khadija and Sheikh Daoud Faisal. I want you to hold on to that name, Sheikh Daoud Faisal, for a little bit. The Nation of Islam, as we're familiar with, is started by Wallace Fard Muhammad, who then had a follower of a man by the name of Elijah Muhammad, who had three important people, and we're going to list them in a minute. So these are basically, this picture is a picture of Al-Hajj Malik Shabazz in the latter part of his life sitting with Sheikh Daoud Faisal. So the Dar es Salaam movement, this is Sheikh Daoud Faisal, is responsible actually for three important people I'm going to miss here. Yahya Abdul Karim, Wali Akram, and H. Rat Brown. Yahya Abdul Karim is extremely important because anything we know about Islam being taught in prison or Islamic materials being brought in prison, this was actually his dawah effort. He began the act of giving dawah to those who were in prison and actually began establishing masajid inside prison. That he had the idea that those who were former prisoner, those who were in prison, could be rehabilitated. And the best way to rehabilitate them was through Islam. And so he was the first to actually begin. So we think, oh, a lot of African Americans became Muslim through prison. Not exactly true. However, it is true for many of them. That Yahya Abdul Karim was actually responsible for the first prison dawah. Right, bringing Islam into the prison system. Wali Akram is extremely important because late into the 80s and the 90s, he was actually responsible for bringing peace between the East Coast and the West Coast gangs. That he's known for that, that he would actually go into the inner city, sit down and talk to them and find ways to squash any animosities or conflict resolution between them. And so as a result, across the United States, they begin to employ his program for how could he bring about conflict resolution in inner city communities. And then we have H. Rat Brown. H. Rat Brown was a part of the Black Power movement, who later became Imam Jamil Alameen. Now, as you can see, Donald Islam started in New York City. But all of them, this movement went from New York to New Jersey to Philadelphia to Washington, D.C., all the way down the coast to Atlanta, where Imam Jamil Alameen was the imam of the Masjid of the Dar es Salaam movement. And it spread as far west into Ohio, into Chicago, and it just began to continue to spread far west all the way until Wali Akram brought it into California when he began to squash the relationship, the conflict between the Bloods and the Crips. I want us to think about why am I mentioning this, because the Islam being used as a social movement, Islam being used for social justice, Islam being used to say that we have the solution to uplift those who are oppressed. Islam being a movement of freedom, this is something that existed from even before. I didn't mention before, this is important, when we were talking about the Quran in chains, that I mentioned Imam Makandau. Imam Makandau was actually allowed himself, he was a Quran teacher whose students began to disappear. He had himself sold into slavery so that he could find out where his students went. When he ended up in Haiti, he became basically, what do you think he became? He started to become halaqa and gatherings, right? And what he began to do, he began teaching them Islam. And then from Islam, he began to teach them revolution. And he began to teach them resistance, right? And so he became responsible. Long story short, he had a student by the name of Imam Bukman. And Bukman became responsible for the Maroons. And the Maroons were basically those who started the beginning of the Haitian Revolution. Imam Bukman had the student by the name of Toussaint Louverture. And Toussaint Louverture, as we know, is responsible for the Haitian Revolution. Now, Haiti at that time, they refused to recognize the independence of Haiti. So European countries basically came together to say, how are we going to squash this, or this slave rebellion is going to spread. And so until this day, they do much to squash the independence of Haiti. In the miracle of unity, I just want to show this picture as we transition into Sheikh Omar Suleiman. And what did that movement give all over the world? Because as we know, Muhammad Ali wasn't only known in America, or Al-Hajj Malik Shabazz wasn't only known in America, or H. Rat Brown of the Black Power Movement wasn't only known in America. Matter of fact, when I was in Turkey over the summer, one of our leaders, he told me he was currently getting his PhD in the philosophy of El Hajj Malik Shabazz. I was like, what? That was his PhD studies in the study of the mind of Malcolm X, Allah yurhamahu. So with that, I will transition, inshallah, for us to further have this discussion. Jazakum Allah khairan. Assalamu alaikum.
You have been listening to Sister Aisha Prime here on Islamic Point of View. Islamic Point of View is a production of the Muslim Community Center of Portland and this station. If you have benefited from today's lecture, you can show your support through a donation at mccpdx.org and kpoo.fm. Follow the Muslim Community Center of Portland on Facebook at facebook.com/Muslim Community Center of Portland for weekly lectures, videos, and updates. Islamic Point of View can be heard each week here on KBOO, Sundays at 8 a.m. Thank you for listening. Have a blessed day. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open